The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jean Latshaw from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from various ladies' magazines, and we begin with this one from Woman's Day. This is Downtime You Deserve, Kickback, Woman's Day's picks for the best in new books, music, and more. Watch TV one day at a time for fans of The Ranch, Fuller House, and Jane the Virgin. In this Netflix gem that ran for three seasons, a single mom, Justina Machado, juggles two kids, a meddling building manager, and an overbearing Cuban mother played by Rita Moreno. Read a book. Inland is the name of the book by Taya Obrecht, O-B-R-E-H-T. And the first name, Taya, spelled T-E-A. For fans of My Antonia by Willa Cather, Animal Dreams by Barbara Kingsolver. This novel alternates between the stories of two beleaguered inhabitants of drought-ridden Arizona Territory in 1893. Nora, a frontierswoman trying to keep her life together after her husband and sons disappear, and Lurie, a haunted outcast on the run from the law across an unforgiving desert. Download a podcast, the Organized 365 podcast. This is for fans of Clean Sweep, Tidying Up with Marie Kondo, and Queer Eye. Home organization expert Lisa Woodruff's combo of advice and humor will inspire you to declutter with a smile. Listen to music. She Won't Make Sense, The Harmalies. For fans of The Lumineers, Regina Spektor and Ingrid Michaelson. The sound of this indie duo's powerful new album ranges from upbeat rock tunes to somber folk, while the raw, emotional lyrics explore mental health issues. Next, from Family Circle, this is a little bit of a humor piece, Parent-Teacher Conferences I've Survived. When it comes to mortifying meetups at my kids' school, here are some standouts. The world is divided into two types of parents, those who love parent-teacher conferences and those who bring their own box of Kleenex. My parents were in the former group. That is because the worst thing they would ever hear about me was, "Your daughter cares too much about school." One year, Mom and Dad were called in for a talk because there was some sort of test and I refused to stop taking it. I was 8. As I recall, there was a question I couldn't solve, but if everyone just left me alone for a few minutes, I'd figure it out and get a perfect score. I became increasingly hysterical, crying and clutching my paper, and eventually some kind of elementary school overachiever SWAT team was dispatched to get me out of there. But really, isn't that the kind of problem every parent would love to have? When my friend, whose brilliant daughter is off to MIT this year, tells me about her child's anxiety issues, I know she's not exaggerating. The girl can't sleep. Another friend told me her child got suspended for a day because she got so engrossed in a book she was reading in the library that she never showed up for class. Being suspended is not great. I know that. So why do I hope these humble braggers get bed bugs? These moms have always looked forward to their parent-teacher conversations. They mark them on their calendars with little happy face emojis. Mine is filled with little skulls and crossbones. I'm queasy for a week beforehand and go to each meeting reeking of Chardonnay and shame. My son Henry is one of the greatest 17-year-olds, well, to people who are not his mother, but he's in no danger of winning the school's Good Citizen Award. Here are a few of the conversations I've heard over the years that still elicit a kind of parental PTSD. In second grade, Henry's teacher said, "Your son is a distraction to himself and others." In addition to being a stark truth, this declaration I feel now, a missed business opportunity. If I'd simply put that statement on a T-shirt and sold it to the moms of sons all across America, I would easily be paying his college tuition right now. Fifth grade. Henry refuses to do the Pledge of Allegiance at graduation practice. He says he doesn't agree with the American government. I said if you give him a note, I can excuse him, but I think he should participate. Thoughts? Yes, here's my thought. My son is an obnoxious jackass. True, you want your child to be an independent thinker, but you do not want a 10-year-old lecturing Mrs. D about the United States' role in fomenting coups. To be fair, Henry's father, a Scot, cheered him on. An enormous family fight ensued. My son, clad in a kilt for graduation, stopped hectoring Mrs. D, but refused to stand or recite the pledge. In short, every time my son graduates a grade, it costs me a small fortune in please accept my apology muffin baskets. And ninth grade, it has come to our attention, ... Let me just say that you never, ever want to hear a teacher start with that sentence, because the next part of it is never going to be that your son is such a good boy. In this case, it came to the school's attention that my then 14-year-old was carrying around a wad of bills, mostly ones and fives, in a rubber band, like some shrimpy apprentice wise guy in Goodfellas. He was running a lunchtime poker game and apparently taking a rake. After this gruesome teacher's conference, I told him I hoped he'd learned his lesson. "Yeah, I should have given a little something to the teachers," he muttered. "Not the lesson I'd hoped for." In 10th grade, Henry's an original thinker, but arguing has a time and place. I've heard versions of this line since he was 5. He had a unique talent for sucking the beauty out of literature. His weapon was logic. This was the discussion he apparently put forth in class while reading Romeo and Juliet. I had to tell the mom that Romeo is kind of demented. First of all, Juliet is basically a child, so he's a perv. Second, if they just shut up and married, it would be better for everyone. Their families would form an alliance that would bring peace to the region. Third, he doesn't even know this girl. They've never had a serious conversation, and he's so depressed he wants to die. Has he never heard there are other fish in the sea? I've left out 11th and 12th grade, not because Henry suddenly learned his lesson. No, it's because I learned my lesson and went to the parent-teacher conferences so sedated that I honestly have no memory of them. Do you think I'm being a bit of a hothouse orchid here? You can do something to make me feel better. Please one-up me by tweeting your most toe-curling parent-teacher moments to @FamilyCircleMag and #TheNewFC, #MyKidsWorseThanYours, or #JudithFeelBetter. The best thing about the beginning of this school year, I will never have to attend another parent-teacher conference. Henry is off to a university in Scotland, where perhaps his contrarian nature, and I, lass, surely his kilt, will come in handy. 2 days ago, I had to provide the school with contact information. They asked for my phone number and email. I hesitated. Next, from Good Housekeeping, they are celebrating 110 years, by the way, of the Good Housekeeping seal with this issue. So every time I do something from Good Housekeeping, there's a possibility it's going to be related to that 110 years of the Good Housekeeping seal. This article, I don't think so, though. 4 ways to teach kids empathy. With the right approach, parents can use the news to get students thinking about the world. As summer fades and kids jump back into learning mode, why not use the headlines to teach students about life outside the classroom? Children have a pure sense of injustice. They're often shocked and can be affected by stories adults treat as white noise. If we teach them to ignore that impulse, they're less likely to care. Instead, the American Academy of Pediatrics suggests that parents and caregivers offer kids age-appropriate translations of the news. That way, you safeguard little ones' emotional well-being while encouraging their sense of compassion. When we were kids, our parents pored over newspapers with us. It helped us develop empathy and sparked our passion to take action on important issues. Now, both dads ourselves, we're compiling best practices. Here are some helpful strategies to interpret the sometimes scary world news about, say, climate change or the migrant crisis to create teaching moments for kids. First, let them lead. To kick off conversations about issues in the news, ask kids what they already know and what questions they have. Let their knowledge and concerns guide your explanation. Help them get the media. Stanford researchers have found that kids have trouble judging the credibility of information online. teach older children what sources to trust and how to identify opinion pieces versus news stories. Answer their questions. Even if your children's understanding of an issue is vague, their anxiety is real. Don't dismiss worries as childish. Listen and take them seriously. And take action together. Pick an issue to tackle as a family. Start with small steps and show your kids they can make a difference. This instills hope rather than fear. Climate change? Reduce your energy consumption at home. A local homeless shelter's closing? Raise awareness among family and friends, or write to municipal authorities. From Family Circle, organize your bag, speed up your morning. The trick to getting out the door in record time? A well-packed bag. Here's how to pull it off. Empty out and question everything. You want to make sure there's not only a good reason for everything in your bag, looking at you, rando digital thermometer, but also a logic to where it goes. Start with your pain point, says Molly Graves, a professional organizer and co-founder of Neat Method. If you're frequently dumping out the contents of your entire bag to locate your keys, only to find them in the back pocket of your jeans, get a lanyard that attaches them to your bag, and it will become muscle memory to simply tug on the tether. And to simplify the tote, keep your bag simple. Sure, you're seduced by the one with all the right-sized and specialized interior and exterior pockets, but trust Graves. You will constantly be forgetting what you put in each pocket, especially when you're in a rush. Also, using a pouch system, more about that on the next page, takes the place of pockets. So pick a pack of pouches. In my mind, having an organized bag means having smaller bags within your bag, Graves says. She recommends a modular setup, a few little pouches, each with its own distinct purpose, one for your makeup, say, and another for office-only things. This system makes it easy to identify essentials and also lets you swap items between bags. Today, the big canvas tote. Tomorrow, your black suede hobo purse, without having to fling everything out. By using pouches, you can also easily lighten your load depending on where you're headed, because seriously, when was the last time you needed or even wanted to look at your work ID on a Saturday? Make your wallet lose weight. Your wallet needs to travel from handbag to work bag and be handy enough to slide into a pocket when you carry nothing at all. Graves likes a mini wallet, which requires paring down that big stack of cards. How many cards do you really need? I have my ID, one credit card, my insurance card, and cash, she says. The limited space in a tiny wallet forces you to be disciplined about what you're always stuffing in there. If you feel naked without your usual fistful of shopper rewards cards and tags, you can consolidate them on your phone with an app like Keyring by scanning their barcodes. And air it out. Teens' backpacks have a way of turning into accidental time capsules with months-old handout sheets, mossy swimsuits, and fossilized food balled up in their deepest, darkest corners. Every kid's backpack or gym bag should have a pouch for stashing sweaty sports clothes that then get tossed into the laundry as soon as they're home. Because just as much as you want to travel light and lean, you want everyone in your family to adopt some tidy bag habits. Graves suggests thinking of a teen's bag as a mailbox, one they empty daily. You want to create habits the entire family practices, she says, that everyone includes you. If you're not keeping up routines, it will be hard for your kids to. And from Good Housekeeping, this is part of the Celebrating 110 Years. History of Headache Relief. When a bad headache hits, it can seem like you're all alone in your misery, but humans have been battling them for many centuries. In fact, in the October 1903 issue of Good Housekeeping, we wrote, quote, "We all have had them, expect to have them, and some of us, alas, hardly know what it is to be without them," unquote. The word headache originated before the 12th century, while migraine came about later in the 15th century, with roots in the Greek word hemicrania. Even in 1903, we knew headaches came in many forms and responded to different treatments. But in the midst of throbbing pain, a person will try nearly anything to feel better. Back then, we recommended soaking in a hot foot bath, using smelling salts, applying menthol, chewing food, and even bathing the forehead as remedies. We also suggested taking antiprine, phenacetin, or antifibrin, three medicines that aren't used anymore for headaches. Now, thankfully, we've come a long way since then. Current treatments are far safer and more effective. Most over-the-counter pain meds available today, such as ibuprofen and acetaminophen, will do the trick for regular headaches. If stress is a trigger, physical therapy for the neck, massage, and stress management techniques can help. When it comes to migraines, your doctor can prescribe medications for prevention and treatment. Preventative drugs that aim to stop an attack from taking hold in the first place include an injectable one approved by the FDA last year, and research has also found injectable onabotulinum toxin A to be effective. And good housekeeping told you first, whole wheat is healthier. In 1913, Dr. Harvey Wiley of the Good Housekeeping Institute bucked traditional norms by declaring whole grains more nutritious than pure white bread and rice. Excess sugar is bad for you. In 1927, we noted, the trouble with sugar is we use too much of it. Back then, we each averaged 100 pounds of the white stuff a year. Today, we eat more than 150 pounds. We've gone the wrong way. Fad diets don't work. In 1914, the article Swindled Getting Slim declared, don't believe anyone who tells you that you can reduce your weight without dieting, exercising, and right living. And last, smoking kills. In 1928, Good Housekeeping alerted readers to the link between smoking and some cancers. In 1952, we stopped accepting cigarette ads, 12 years before the U.S. Surgeon General issued a report on the hazards of tobacco. From Woman's Day, clever uses for clear nail polish, shiny tricks to try at home. First up, thread a needle. Dip the end of a piece of thread in clear polish. When it's dry and stiff, it can be easily pushed through a needle's eye. To preserve your costume jewelry, brush a layer of polish inside a ring to prevent it from turning your finger green. Keep labels smudge-free. Coat the labels of outdoor items like mailboxes and potted plants with polish to keep them from smudging in moist environments. And to secure small screws, paint a layer of clear polish over eyeglass screws to keep them in place. And last, seal envelopes. Instead of licking the flaps, you can spread on a thin layer of clear polish, press down, and let it dry. And did you know that nail enamel was first created 5,000 years ago in China? All right, we move on to some recipes from Family Circle. Dinner tonight, lunch tomorrow. September means back to busy. Thank goodness for these double duty recipes that get dinner on the table and bust you out of your sad desk lunch rut. First, for the dinner, Fontina basil and bacon grilled cheese. Arrange 12 slices bacon on a rack over a foil-lined rimmed sheet pan. Roast at 400 degrees for about 20 minutes and cool. Meanwhile, shred 12 ounces Fontina cheese over 6 slices of your preferred sandwich bread. Sprinkle half the shredded cheese. Break cooled bacon in half and place 4 halves on each slice. Top bacon with torn fresh basil to taste. Sprinkle with remaining cheese. Pour bacon fat from the pan into a small measuring cup and, if needed, add enough EVU, that's extra virgin olive oil, to equal a quarter cup. Brush one side of 6 more slices of bread with half the bacon fat and place on cheese fat side up. Place sandwiches fat side down on a large hot electric griddle or work in batches in a skillet. Brush top of each sandwich with remaining bacon fat. Cook until crispy. 2 to 3 minutes per side. Serve warm, and this serves 4. And for tomorrow, fully loaded grilled cheese sandwiches are a loaded and are a legit and irresistible dinner, and then make a few extra, chop them into croutons, and make your green salad over the top. For the lunch, grilled cheese salad. Cut extra fontina, basil, and bacon grilled cheese into cubes and toss with chopped romaine and tomato wedges. Serve with green goddess dressing. This serves two, and here's your little recipe for the green goddess dressing. Add half cup each reduced fat mayo and reduced fat sour cream, the zest of one lemon plus one tablespoon lemon juice, two scallions, white and green parts roughly chopped, two tablespoons each packed fresh parsley stems and leaves and chopped chives or dill, and a quarter teaspoon each salt and black pepper to a blender. Blend until smooth, stopping to scrape sides as needed. And that makes 1 1/3 cups. And as a little sidebar, for crunchier croutons, toast the leftover sandwiches for a few minutes, let cool, and then cut. The next one, the dinner. Tomato and spinach mini ravioli. Bring a large pot of salted water to a boil over high. Cook 1 minute, less than package directions. Reserve a half cup pasta cooking water, then drain. Meanwhile, in a large skillet, heat 2 tablespoons of evu over medium-high. Add 4 cloves garlic, thinly sliced. Cook 30 seconds. Add 2 pints halved grape tomatoes and a half teaspoon salt. Cook 5 minutes. Working in batches, stir in 10-ounce baby spinach chopped and 1/4 teaspoon salt. Cook 2 minutes. Remove from heat and stir in the ravioli, 1 cup parsley chopped, 1 cup shaved parmesan, 1/4 cup of the reserved pasta water, and cracked black pepper to taste. Stir well. Add more salt and pasta water as needed. Serve with additional parmesan, parsley, and pepper if desired. And this serves 4. A go pack of broth and a zap in the break room's microwave transforms that hearty dinner into a lighter but still filling soup. So the lunch, pasta and white bean soup. Pack any leftover tomato and spinach mini ravioli, sauce and all, with an additional handful of torn baby spinach and some drained and rinsed cannellini, navy, or great northern beans. When you're ready to eat, pour in 1 8.25-ounce container vegetable broth and stir to combine. Heat in microwave 3 minutes. Sprinkle with extra shaved parmesan and cracked black pepper if desired. And this serves 1. The next one, the dinner, chicken ramen. In a medium saucepan, bring 2 quarts unsalted chicken broth, 1 tablespoon sliced ginger, 3 cloves garlic sliced, and 3/4 teaspoon salt to a boil. Reduce heat to medium-low and add 1 1/4 pounds boneless, skinless chicken breasts. Simmer until cooked through about 10 minutes. Transfer to a cutting board and let cool slightly, then shred. Stir 2 tablespoons reduced sodium soy sauce and 1 tablespoon rice vinegar into the broth. Meanwhile, bring a pot of salted water to a boil. Cook 2 packages chicken ramen noodles 3 minutes. Reserve seasoning packet and drain. Divide noodles and chicken among 4 bowls and ladle in the hot broth. Top with shredded carrot and thinly sliced radish and scallion. Add halved perfect ramen eggs, for which I have a recipe next, if desired, and this serves 4. The perfect ramen eggs, in a medium saucepan, bring 3 inches of water to a boil, reduce heat to medium for a strong simmer. Add 4 cold large eggs and cook 7 minutes. Transfer to a bowl of ice water for 1 minute, peel and cut in half. When you're done with dinner, just drain off the broth, and then everything, including the noodles, is ready for a wrap. The lunch, spicy chicken lettuce wraps. Drain broth from chicken ramen and toss leftover chicken, vegetables, and noodles with sriracha mayo to taste. Add a splash of rice vinegar and season with the ramen seasoning packet that you reserved before. Pack clean butter lettuce leaves separately and fill with chicken salad when you're ready to eat. And this serves 1. The dinner, sheet pan sausage and broccoli rabe. On a rimmed baking sheet, toss 2 bunches trimmed broccoli rabe, about 1 1/2 pounds, with 2 tablespoons evu, 1 teaspoon dried oregano, 3/4 teaspoon salt, and 1/4 teaspoon crushed red pepper. On a second rimmed baking sheet, toss 4 seeded and sliced bell peppers, a mix of colors looks pretty, and 4 small shallots sliced, with 2 tablespoons evu, 1 teaspoon dried oregano, 3/4 teaspoon salt, and 1/4 teaspoon crushed red pepper. Slide peppers over and add 1 pound hot Italian sausage links, turning to coat with oil. Add both pans to the oven and roast at 450 for 20 minutes, tossing everything halfway through. Meanwhile, prepare 1 8.8-ounce box of quick-cooking polenta according to package directions, adding salt and butter to taste. Spoon some polenta onto 4 plates, slice sausage into coins, and serve with polenta and vegetables. Serves 4. Make that leftover polenta work even harder and try it for breakfast. Remember, it's just cornmeal. You can top it with a fried egg or drizzle it with maple syrup. But for your lunch, sausage and broccoli Rob Hoagie. Layer any leftover sausage and vegetables from sheet pan sausage and broccoli Rob that you had for dinner into the center of a hinge-cut hoagie with sliced provolone, fresh mozzarella, or crumbled feta, and pesto, garlic mayo, red pepper hummus, or tapenade. Serves 1. Well, now I'm hungry. And let's see what else we have. From Good Housekeeping, party like it's 1958. Appetizers were all the rage, so much so that we wrote a book about them. Peek inside GH's appetizer book. We'll let you decide if its charming advice stands the test of time. Here are some examples. Napkins, of course. You'll want to provide a cocktail-sized napkin for each guest. Today, gay little paper ones are seen everywhere, with a few cherished linen ones making an appearance now and then. Next, from 1958, a drink is a must. A drink of some kind is a prerequisite when a nibbler is served. The two are inseparable, whether the occasion is a prelude to a dinner or a party in itself. Just 2, please. Another happy trend is the serving of only 1, 2, or 3 kinds of nibblers, with plenty of each. Preparation is certainly easier, and the results more appealing than an overwhelming array. And the last, be dashing, be daring. Don't be trite in selecting the container for displaying your wares. A cake stand needn't be confined for cake, or a bread basket to bread. Appetizers lend themselves perfectly to imaginative serving. And from Real Simple, some thoughts. Aprils have never meant much to me. Autumns seem that season of beginning spring. And that was a Truman Capote quote from Breakfast at Tiffany's. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Ladies Magazines. Be sure and listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I am Jean Latshaw, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.